Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the news and politics editor at Crosscut. Republicans and Democrats don't often agree, and these days, environmental policy is no exception, especially climate policy. The response to the Green New Deal highlighted the clear divisions between the parties. Most Democrats stood behind it, while most Republicans ridiculed it. And while the gap is closing, surveys show that Democrats across the country still support action on climate change in greater numbers than Republicans do. So is there a path forward for bipartisan environmental policy? Crosscut asked leaders from both parties with expertise in these issues to discuss what it might take to get us there. Bill Bryant has served in both Democratic and Republican administrations as an advisor to the USDA and as a member of Congress's Advisory Committee on Agriculture, Trade, and the Environment. He was elected to the Seattle King County Port Commission in 2007 and served until 2016, the same year he became the Republican candidate for Washington State Governor. He is founder and currently serves as chairman of Bryant Christie Incorporated. Hillary Franz is the Washington State Commissioner of Public Lands. She's a Democrat and was elected in 2016. In her role, she protects and manages 6 million acres of public land in Washington State, from forest to farms. She worked for several decades as an environmental attorney and as executive director of a conservation nonprofit. Bob Inglis is executive director of Republican.org, a nonprofit that supports free market solutions to climate change. He served a total of 12 years as a U.S. representative from South Carolina. He lost his seat in 2010 after he began publicly advocating for a carbon tax. For his work on climate change, Inglis was given the 2015 John F. Kennedy Profile in Courage Award. John Carlson is a radio host on commercial talk station KVI in Seattle and a columnist at Crosscut. He moderated the discussion. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast and the Nature Conservancy. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, Congressman, come on up. I appreciate all of you being here. I guess this is the last panel. They save the best for last. How about that? Bigger crowd than expected. I probably shouldn't have floated the rumor that Macklemore won't be joining us after all, but thank you all for making it. It is very hard in this day and age, both in Washington, D.C. and in Olympia, to form common cause on virtually any issue. And the environment is an issue where we used to have bipartisan coalitions all the time. And increasingly, that appears more and more elusive. Why is that? And how do we get back to bipartisan coalitions? What a great panel we have to help make that happen. Hillary Franz, of course, is Washington's lands commissioner. Don't ask me why, but we elect our own interior secretary in the state of Washington. 6 million acres of public lands is under her stewardship. A lot of responsibility going with it. We were talking beforehand. She says, basically, you spend a little bit of time where you live, a little bit of time in Olympia, and a whole lot of time everywhere else across Washington. Bill Bryant, former port commissioner in Seattle, grew up, my goodness, you grew up in Hoodsport, and you started your career in Eastern Washington, Yakima. Now, of course, in the trade business in Seattle, joined the Port of Seattle, ran for governor in 2016, and like so many outstanding Republican candidates, took home the silver medal. It's good to have you here with us.
It sounds so good. I know.
Bob Inglis, Republican, former Republican member of Congress, 12 years from South Carolina. floated the idea of a carbon tax in his race for Congress. What year was it, Bob? That
2009.
Yes, and found that it was not wildly popular there. He is now the executive director of RepublicN, that's EN.org. So I want to start by asking each of you, what do you think is the most important national environmental issue? What is the most important issue here to our state? And do you think that there is a bipartisan coalition that can be had on either one of those two issues? Can we start with you, Commissioner Franz?
And yes, of course. I want to make sure you went and talked about it as number one environmental issue.
Yes.
Is that what you want our answer?
Yes, please.
Okay, I want to make sure for the audience. As I look out, and obviously in my role, I oversee 6 million acres of land in Washington State, and about 2 million acres of forest land, 1 million acres of agricultural land. We are the largest wheat grower actually in the state, and probably the largest vineyard grower. Also 2.6 million acres of aquatic lands for shellfish and salmon and critical habitat and play. And also head up the wildfire fighting team for the state. I'll tell you, at the national level and the state level, I think the most significant environmental crisis we're facing at both levels really is a rapidly changing climate that is leading to, one, an unbelievable pace and scale of forest crisis, where we're seeing dying disease trees at an unbelievable pace that's leading to more catastrophic wildfires. We're seeing in our state significant drought, and across the nation where we are now experiencing dust storms right here in Washington State, similar to what not at the level that my grandparents experienced in the Great Depression in South Dakota, but I wouldn't be surprised if we won't experience that going forward. And then we're seeing a huge die-off in the context of our aquatic lands, of our shellfish and obviously salmon and orca populations. And honestly, the greatest crisis is the environmental context and change of how we're going to be ensuring that we have water and food to survive in this state and in this nation.
Excellent. Very much. Thank you very much. Bill Bryant.
Well, I'm going to agree and then slightly disagree, but not really, because I agree with everything the commissioner
said. Getting off to a good start already.
No, I agree. But we agree that the most pressing national and global issue is climate change. I don't think that you can put any other environmental issue above it. If we look at the impact that we're already experiencing all around the country, and if you think of it nationally, we have rising sea levels, which are affecting communities in Florida and Virginia right now. It is no longer hypothetical that sea levels are rising, particularly during storm events. If we look just here in Washington State, we can see the impact on certain aquatic lands, and we can see it in eastern Washington. We have to separate weather from climate, but overall, when weather begins to accumulate year after year and after decade, we have to realize that these rising carbon levels are beginning to change the environment in the North Cascades and throughout Washington State. So nationally, whether we're talking about Virginia or Florida or up here in the Pacific Northwest or in California, climate change by far is the number one issue. In Washington State, I want to put something slightly above climate change, and that is Puget Sound. And the only reason I put it above it is because really, at the end of the day, and this is not totally popular in all corners, there's very little in Washington State we can do about climate change. Because we are already very green, and our emissions could go to zero. They're already so low, and it's not going to have any effect on the rest of the planet. And there are international and national organizations and initiatives to deal with climate change. No one else can save Puget Sound except us. That's on us. And we have probably 10 to 15 years to do it. And if we do not get this turned around in the next decade or 15 years, we will go beyond a point where it will be like the Chesapeake Bay, and we will spend billions and billions, and we will never have anything to show for it. So if I want to talk about the number one issue in Washington State, and one that I am committed to and have been for years, it is we have got to race ahead of the clock and reverse the degradation to our habitat and to our waters and to our tidelands. That part of it is tied into climate change, but most of it is non-point source pollution that's on all of us.
Very good. Thank you very much, Bill Bryant. Congressman Inglis.
Yeah, so I think everybody here is very familiar with Bill and Hillary. I, I first got elected.
That's how we marketed the panel. We just said Bill and Hillary will be here.
Yeah. In fact, that's I was. Yeah, they just said that Bill and Hillary were coming, and so I was first elected to Congress when Bill and Hillary got elected in 1992, and then served 6 years saying climate change is nonsense. I didn't know anything about it except that Al Gore was for it. And that was the end of the inquiry, as far as I was concerned, in probably the reddest district of the reddest state of the nation, Greenville, Spartanburg, South Carolina. Then I was out 6 years doing commercial real estate law again, ran again in 04. And my son came to me and said, Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment. And so that, plus a trip to Antarctica, and then a somewhat of a spiritual awakening, another science committee trip, Great Barrier Reef, caused me to get engaged in climate. And so my answer to your question, John, would be, I think that the top three issues facing us in the environment are climate, climate, and climate, but I would divide those into three parts. One is some sort of pricing mechanism for emissions, because we are so close to the worst impacts coming upon us that we need to act very quickly. And the most dynamic force that I know that could deliver solutions is the free enterprise system. And so the best way to do that is to internalize negative externalities. I once said that to the Greenville News, the largest newspaper that I represent in the district that I represented, and the guy stopped me and said, "What did you say?" And I said, "We need to internalize negative externalities." He said, "I can't write this that in this paper, man. We write at the seventh grade level." And so I said, "Reveal the hidden costs." And he said, the next day in the paper, it said, "Engler said we need to reveal the hidden costs." So that's what a pricing mechanism does. It internalizes and reveals the hidden cost associated with burning of fossil fuels. So that I'd put as the first issue about climate. The second is figure out some way to do direct air capture, because in order to head off where we're otherwise going, we're going to have to do that very effectively. And then a third thing that, as Hillary just mentioned about the importance of agriculture, particularly in the eastern part of the state, is somehow figuring out a way to do something well with agriculture in ways that are beyond my writ, really. It's a very complicated area, but there are things to be done about climate in the field of agriculture to make agriculture more sustainable. And so those three things. One is a pricing mechanism. Second is figuring out a way to do direct air capture. And then third, better agriculture.
Very good. Hillary Franz.
Yeah, I just want to... oftentimes we're thinking about climate change, or we're seeing the change in climate, we're thinking about the hurricanes and the tornadoes, and we're seeing the sea level rise, and we're thinking it's somewhere out there, not in Washington State, and it hasn't touched us yet. I'm going to tell you, my agency is on the front lines every single day of a rapidly changing climate and how it is attacking every single community. Whether it's in April of last year, where we had the most significant flood in Okanagan since 1973 with the rapid melt of snowpack from Canada, and now every city along that river was being flooded, homes and communities, and we had to respond with our firefighters because there was no one else to respond. Or the context where we're seeing thousands of acres of our evergreen state turning brown. In fact, millions of acres, with 2.7 million acres of forest in Washington State alone dying. Obviously, the catastrophic fires everyone saw. And we're seeing it obviously in the context of ocean acidification and a changing climate in our waterways that is decimating what is our most native and wild special species. Now, most people are saying, wait, but we're a small state, and us to respond to climate change, how much can we really do? What we are missing as most important and front and center in Washington State is actually investing in making the state more resilient to a rapidly changing climate. Right? We tend to, in our state, invest after the fact to a crisis. We react. We need to be investing proactively in how do we set up the state to ensure that it has the water resources, the agricultural resources, the forest resources, that we are making it more resilient and using our dollars up front proactively, because it will be a lot cheaper on the front end. And that's the work we've been doing in forest health. We are now treating 70,000 acres a year of forests that is removing that dead, dying disease disease trees. We move it into the mills, which grows our rural economies, that now creates cross-laminated timber, which is one of the most sustainable and affordable wood product right here in Washington State, that now can create more affordable housing within our urban areas. If we're up front, we can save it from going into smoke and flames and actually create more resilient state, more resilient communities.
Very good. Real quickly, Bill Bryant.
Well, I was going to say that if we were trying to figure out how to bridge a partisan divide, the commissioner's statement is where we can begin. Because we can, as long as we all admit that climate change is occurring, but let's move beyond that whole thing. But talking about what to do, there is a great deal of support for dealing with resiliency and infrastructure development to deal with the change that we know is coming. We have got to expand our water retention capacity in the mountains, not only for the east side, but for the west side as well. But definitely for the east side, because we're still getting the snowpack or we're getting the rainfall, but it's all gone by Memorial Day. It's washing out into the Pacific Ocean. We need to be able to capture that melting snow and that rainwater up in the mountains and then slowly release it to simulate what would have happened if it were melting at a normal rate. That's not only going to continue to support the populations of central and eastern Washington and our agricultural industries over there, but it's going to help salmon.
Well, right, but
it's going to help entire ecosystems. And that is something that both we're talking about. This is about partisan divide, not climate change. But if we want to come together, that is something that we can, and I would argue already have come together on with the Yakima Basin Enhancement Project. And most recently, and that was on the state level, totally bipartisan. And then most recently, the National Natural Resources Act, which was put together and supported on a bipartisan basis here in Washington State by Republican Dan Newhouse and by Democrat Maria Cantwell.
Okay. So you've all highlighted climate change as an important issue, and you all have attached various scenarios about undesirable, even disastrous things that are happening or could happen or will happen as a result. And yet the American people, whenever they are asked to rank issues in terms of most important versus least important, if you give them 15 choices, climate change and the environment come up 14th or 15th. Why do you think that is? This time we're going to start with Mr. Inglis and come back around this way.
Actually, I think there's some research on that Stanford has done. And what it shows is if you ask people what's their most important issue, it typically will be economy, healthcare, jobs, things that are personal. But if you state the question, what should our nation's priorities be? Climate change jumps way up the list because there is a sense in which the odd thing about climate change is it's not the normal think globally, act locally. It's more like the reverse of that. It's in order to solve climate change, you have to act globally and think locally. Because the problem with climate change is emissions anywhere are climate change everywhere. And so you have to figure out a way to get China and India in on this. And so there's a sense of, I don't know what to do. I can't do anything about it. And if something is that, most of us put it down on the list of salience for us, right? Because if there's something I can't avoid, I just have to accept it. But what we need to do is figure out a way to, if you ask it, though, if there, what should be our nation's priorities, it goes way up the list.
Okay, Bill, and then Hillary.
Well,
Sounds funny. They were just here last night, you know.
I agree with the congressman. If you are concerned about the fact that you can't afford your rent anymore, and you're going to have to move out to Sammamish or Sultan to get a house that you can afford to buy or rent. But if I move out to Sammamish or Sultan, now my 20-minute commute has just become an hour and 20 minutes. And we got people talking about raising the gas tax. And by the way, I got to keep my job in Seattle because I'm concerned about my health care if I don't. Yeah, climate change just isn't rising to the top of what I'm going to wake up at 3 o'clock worried about. But there's an opportunity in that. I think when we talk about partisan, bridging the partisan divide, because it's not right up at the top. If we don't turn it into a partisan football, I think we have some maneuverability and flexibility to come together in a way we wouldn't if it is the issue people are waking up at 3 o'clock worried about, such as healthcare.
Okay, Hillary.
Yeah, so I agree. I think part of the big context, if you're somebody who is trying to just keep a roof over your head or try to feed your family, or you're piecing odd job after odd job together to stay alive, how do you have the mental or emotional capacity to get educated on climate change, get engaged on climate change, and be able to act on climate change, right? We have to look at this from really a different frame. And then another piece of that I'll just add is oftentimes it does feel way out there. Like, how could my one person be able to shift the tide on a rapidly changing climate? It feels like it's so removed from the ability for us to create change as one person or one family or even one community or one state. We have to change that context, right? And I think the important thing is, and that's part of why I'll use the example of forest health, right, is when we take forest health and we built a bipartisan support from that, not only East and West, but Republican and Democrat, that says we have significant forests that are dying and they are leading to catastrophic wildfires. If I can turn that into the mill, I now create jobs in some of the most economically depressed communities, which now is creating an economic opportunity to put food on the table in a long term. These are communities that have had 9 to 12% unemployment for generations in our state. We are now then able to have an economic opportunity come from an environmental crisis, an environmental challenge. There are a number of those. You talked about the context of water resources and where we're seeing more water at one part of the year and less in another. We're now working on clean energy. We've done 21 wind leases. We just did our first solar lease. We have 34 more leases to go where we're actually creating jobs, creating more economic opportunity in some of the most rural communities that have not had opportunity. And now we're looking at pump storage opportunity, which is one of those contexts of clean energy, growing economy, helping address the agriculture water resource, as well as the in-stream flow issues for our salmon, critically challenged. When we start to knit the environment and economy together with solutions that build community resilience and climate resilience, we will be able to get at this context of where prioritization is for okay. every single person.
So let's go from the general to the specific. There have been, here in Washington State, a couple of specific solutions tied to fighting climate change. There was an initiative on the ballot that would have imposed a carbon tax in exchange for tax cuts in other areas. Some of you might remember seeing that on the ballot. It was actually very intriguing. But it went down by double digits. And for one thing, it divided the environmental community. Then last year, we had Initiative 1631 that again would have imposed a tax, you know, on the polluters, or a pollution fee as it was called, which was quickly translated into, here's how much it will cost you in higher gasoline prices. Here is how much it will cost you in higher home heating costs. And on election day, it too went down by double digits. So if you can't get something like that passed here in clean, green, and blue Washington State, what can you get passed? And this time we'll start with Hillary, go to Bill, and then...
Carbon tax, man.
I'm ready.
Here, yeah. We're going to ask the congressman from South Carolina to talk about why Washington said no.
Yeah, because because I'll tell you.
It was like, I know.
A pair of initiatives. Yeah. Go for it, then.
I'll tell you why. Because it's like this. The killer argument against 732 and 1631 is the killer argument about against any state initiative. And that is, you can't adjust at the border. That's the problem with a state acting. Bless states who are willing to go first. But it puts you in a tough spot. It's like Illinois has enormous deficit problems. If they did a carbon tax, they'd get enormous revenue, right? But there are billboards up around Chicago that say, Illinois yet moved Indiana. And so if Illinois were to do a carbon tax, all you get to do is pick up and move your plant across the border to Indiana, and you don't pay a carbon tax. And so it's a problem when a state acts. Only the federal government can impose a border adjustment. So we say to the Chinese, glad to have your goods. It's just you're going to pay our carbon tax on entry unless you have the same carbon tax at home. They challenge in the World Trade Organization. They lose based on precedents in the chemical industry. And then 24 hours later, because they get an amazing way of reaching consensus, they would have the same price on carbon dioxide. Otherwise, they're paying a tax on entry through the Port of Seattle that's ending up in Washington that they could have collected in China, and it would have ended up in Beijing. 24 hours later, they got the same price on carbon dioxide, and you've overcome that border problem. And then all 50 states and all countries of the world are seeing that internalized price of the burning of fossil fuels that I talked about, so that everybody's now seeing the true cost of energy. So that was the challenge of 732 and of 1631. It seems to me that's the killer argument against both.
Did this man do his homework or what? No, always. Very good. Thank you. We're going to go to Hillary and then to Bill.
I think that is a lot of what's going on. A lot of times what we're seeing in our state too is, how is it going to make a difference here in Washington State? Whether it's on a carbon sequestration context or a carbon or climate adaption, right? And what people, our voters want and our community members want, is to know, if we're going to make a bold step forward, how is it going to make a difference in my life and in this state? Right? Not only on an environmental context, but also on a social economic. So I'll give you an example of how we're shifting this frame in our work in our agency, recognizing that when it's out there, it feels very far removed from the people's everyday lives and how it's going to make a difference in their community or their state. We at my agency oversee 6 million acres of land, like I said, and agriculture, commercial, industrial, and timber, and also aquatic lands, forest lands. And we recognize that we are seeing a rapid change to these landscapes, and that if we don't understand that change that's happening and begin to build more resilient landscapes, we will fail in our responsibilities to our state, to our communities, and to generating revenue for our schools and counties, which we are in all 39 counties. So we developed a climate adaption plan that we are now going forward on our 6 million acres of land to say, how do we set them up for the long term to be more resilient in the face of a rapidly changing climate? We recognize, and I recognize, that while we oversee 6 million acres of land, we're in all 39 counties of the state. And much of the landscapes that we're interfacing are the same landscapes that those counties and communities are. Many of those communities don't have the resources and capacity, though, to understand what the problem is and also what the solutions are for resilience. So we've begun doing community conversations with those communities who are most on the front lines. And so just a few months ago, we actually were, myself and my agency, we were in Chelan and Wenatchee, right? A community that has been struggling with forest fires, struggling with forest health, drought, Yakima and Grayson Basin, a lot of the water resources. Agriculture is a big part of their economy, as well as recreation, and they're socked in with smoke most of the summer. And we invited everyone in a leadership role to come. And we all know this community is very much a Republican community. I will tell you, we had over 60 people of the leadership from the fire districts, the sheriffs, from the county commissioners, from the local government to the schools, all engage in a conversation that says, we already know that what we're seeing today is only going to get worse if we're not addressing the problem. And they asked us, my agency, to work with them to be able to set up a long-term resilience plan for that community, from forest health and wildfire to agriculture and to the water resources and clean energy.
Bill Bryant, back about 6 years ago,
I don't get to answer the question about how we're going to pass the statewide initiative.
Oh, I thought you were simply going to agree with Hillary and move on from there. Okay, go ahead.
I can disagree with Hillary, but I want to put a little finer point on it. I think if we want to, and this comes back to bridging the partisan divide, if we want to pass a statewide initiative on climate change, or let's say a major initiative to deal with stormwater and Puget Sound, we can't go about doing it the way that we have done it the previous two times, which were incredibly partisan. If you have a group of environmental organizations and environmental community leaders, and I'd like to think of myself of that, but the Democrat environmental community leaders, all sitting around and writing an initiative and not inviting people like me into the room, then there's no reason for us to go bleed for it when it's on the ballot, and we have no ownership in it. Now, bringing people like me and others into the room is going to mean the initiative isn't going to reflect 100% of what that group wants. You want to know how you bridge the partisan divide? You compromise. You figure out what we all can get behind, and you put that on the ballot. And then everybody goes out arm in arm and sells it to their own base. And that's how we're going to get it done. The other thing we've got to do, one more thing, is that, and this comes to the Congressman's point about carbon tax, particularly if we're thinking about how do we get votes in Central and Eastern Washington. We can't just run an initiative that makes everybody here all happy. You're going to have to get votes from Central and Eastern Washington. Barbara and I have a place over in the Mattel Valley, okay? If I want to go into town, it's about a 4 or 5 mile drive. If I need to go get something in a big box store, a Walmart or something like that, I got to go over a mountain pass and it's an hour. If I need to get the car serviced, it's Wenatchee. That's 2 hours one way. You can drive the price of gasoline with a carbon tax up to $7 a gallon. I still got to drive that way because I have no alternative. And while we must internalize the costs, if we don't, we're not going to change behavior unless there's an alternative for people to do something different. And in the absence of that behavior, all you've done is drive up the price of gasoline, and no one's going to vote to do that. So while we've got to focus on a bipartisan solution, that's got to also involve significant commitments to technological change that are going to provide people in Central and Eastern Washington with an alternative they don't have right now.
And that actually gets to something I wanted to ask each of you about. Do you think that national environmental organizations have become more partisan or more strident in recent years? Start with you, Congressman.
Yes. In fact, particularly the ratings are bogus. I had an F with every organization you want an A with, including Republicans for Environmental Protection. And the ratings have gotten even worse. And really, I mean, I realize I'm in Seattle, not Eastern Washington, which is one of our focuses. We're one of the places we're focusing at republican.org is in Kathy McMorris Rogers district. But I realize I'm in Seattle, not there. But I'll tell you, some of the groups are really just adjuncts of the Democratic Party. In fact, they all tie in with something called VAN, the Voter Activation Network. So all these environmental groups tie in with essentially the Democratic Party. And so the voting, the methodology of their ratings are designed to produce a situation where a Republican cannot be supported by that group, and only the Democrat will be supported. So they send out the letters to the mamas and the papas, and they say, send us $35 and we will save you from Armageddon. And oh, by the way, it's only Democrats that will do that. And so it's what Bill was just indicating. That creates a situation where and if you walked around the halls of Capitol Hill right now in Washington and asked Republican senators and House members if they care what, fill in the name of, I won't name any of the groups, the big ones, the big environmental groups, if they care what any of them think, they'd sort of spit on the ground, because they know there is no way you can make them happy. No way at all. And so it's really up to Democrats to say, time out, enough of this. Let's figure out a way to get away from those rankings that make it so a Republican can never be acceptable, and sort of undo sort of the Democratic machine there.
Thank you, Bob. Bill Bryant, one of the reasons we have North Cascades National Park is because of former Republican Governor Dan Evans. The reason we have a National Environmental Policy Act is because of Democratic Senator Scoop Jackson. Are those days of bipartisanship working together, but remember the first EPA administrator was Bill Ruckelshaus, who now lives here. Are those days gone?
And that the Olympics are largely preserved because of the acts of four different Republican presidents.
Okay, so.
I agree with everything the congressman said. If we, your question specifically was on, are those days gone? I think that's up to us. Because if we really begin to do our research and begin to support people who care about the environment and look beyond the party tag, and there are a lot of Republicans who support the environment, but that's not consistent with the narrative. If we do that and not follow the endorsements or the ratings of some of these groups, then I think we can begin to pull together and rebuild the bipartisan consensus that existed for many years. But because of a lot of these environmental organizations, that is dying or dead. I'll give you a first-person example. Barbara and I, for years, long before I ever ran for office, were major donors to Washington Conservation Voters. We were Earth Angels, and we supported their projects. For years before I ever ran. I get ready to run for office. I'm running against a Democrat incumbent. A Democrat incumbent who wants to gut the funding source for the environmental programs at the Port of Seattle. So I go in for my endorsement interview. I've been working with these people. I know them for a long time. They know me. We have a great interview. I don't get the endorsement. And I said, okay, so what's up? And they said, well, we're going to support the Democrat because he's the incumbent. Okay. I win anyway, and I continue to work with them. Ron Sims, the county exec at the time, and I even co-chaired and emceed their annual auction one year. I voted consistent with how they wanted me to on everything, just because that's where I was as well, and went beyond that. Commissioner Tarleton, now Legislator Tarleton, and I put together a clean air initiative that was applauded by the American Lung Association for Environmental Justice. We did great groundwork, groundbreaking work on stormwater at the port. We electrified the crew, the ground facilities at SeaTac Airport. We were the first airport in the country to have a greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, this was a green port because of a lot of our work. I thought it was going to be a slam dunk when I walked into that endorsement interview. One, I had to fight for it, because they'd wanted to delay it. So if they gave it to me, I couldn't get it into the voter's pamphlet. It would miss the deadline. And then when I got in there, it was hostile. Now listen, if you had had a Democrat the first time around who had been with the organization for years and been a major donor, and who was running against a Republican incumbent who wanted to gut the funding source for environmental programs, do you think they would have endorsed the Republican because he was the incumbent? No. And they were trying to figure out how they could endorse the Democrat when I ran for re-election, but they just couldn't quite get there given my record.
Okay.
As long as that's the case, we're not going to rebuild that Scoop Dan consensus that saves so much of the state. And we have got to get beyond these organizations that find it very lucrative to put out direct mail that drives us apart. And we've got to quit responding to that direct mail.
Hillary Franz.
Yeah, so I will tell you right now, we started this conversation with this context about climate change and how we're seeing that every single day present in our lives. No matter where you are in the state, we're all being impacted by it. The reality is we don't have time to waste in division and divisiveness. We don't. We are out of time when it comes to addressing homelessness and mental health and education and our environmental crisis. And the best thing we can do is finally really realize that we are more than the letter behind our name.
So are you agreeing?
Well, let me finish this, because this is really important. No, this is really important.
I think she's launching my next campaign.
So every single year, I put thousands of firefighters on the front line. They put their lives at stake for the communities of Washington State. And never once did those firefighters say, hey, before I protect your home or your community, how do you vote? They don't. They see every single human life as valuable, no matter where they live, no matter their zip code, no matter how much money they make, no matter how they vote. If we're going to change the way we do business in Olympia or in Congress, we need to start recognizing that every single human life is valuable. And we need to start realizing the more we're working together across urban-rural divides, east, west, north, south, Republican and Democrat, the more we will get done, because we will recognize that we actually truly have common values. And that is not more front and center than when it comes to the context of a changing climate, where we're watching so much of our basic needs, from the wood that creates the shelter we need to the food and water we depend on.
So quick clarification before we go to questions from our audience. Yes. Quick clarification before we go to the audience questions, and that is, do you think that some of these environmental organizations that were cited by name are an asset or a liability right now toward reaching what you're talking about?
So I would tell you, like anything, just like you can't say a Republican is bad and a Democrat is bad, right? We're all different. Same with our organizations. I will tell you, and I can't speak at the national level, right? But at the state level, we have organizations that right now that are environmental organizations that are working tirelessly with Republicans and Democrats in all parts of our state to address the pressing climate challenge we have. For example, the Nature Conservancy is one of those organizations that worked with us and worked with broad leadership in developing the 20-year forest health plan. They have gone into those communities. They're understanding what is the challenge that's being faced there, not just environmentally, but economically and socially, and saying, how do we knit these problems together with a common solution? And they're making progress. And so what I would say is, don't ever, just like with humans, we should never do a broad cloth judgment that certain people are bad or certain organizations are bad. And what we should do is say, we can show success by inviting organizations to come into the community level, and they will be better off and they will get better results to their mission and our mission if they do that.
And John, okay, to be clear, I didn't cast an aspersion across all environmental groups. The commissioner is absolutely right. You have organizations like the Washington Wildlife and Recreation Coalition that was founded by Governor Dan Evans and Governor Mike Lowry.
Lowry, yeah.
That totally is a bipartisan and very successful because of it. Mm-hmm. Long Live the Kings and a number of Puget Sound organizations, an organization I founded. Salmon Recovery, the Nisqually Watershed Foundation, River Foundation. These are not partisan organizations at all. These are organizations committed to helping protect the environment. It's when you get an organization that begins at their breakfast to talk about how we have to elect a Democratic majority that you realize the focus is more on politics than protecting our environment.
Got it, because we're beyond our time here for audience questions. We got to get to them. Quick answers, if we can. The quicker our answers are, the more questions we can get in. Why is nuclear power not a more widely supported area of development among progressives, since it is carbon neutral? We'll start here and go straight through and then reverse order later.
I think it's because there's a significant risk of potential nuclear damage and nuclear release. I mean, Washington State has the most amount of nuclear missiles, I think, in the nation. And obviously people operate within a sense of fear of that impact. You said short. I did short.
You did short.
Real short. I don't know.
Thank you, Bob.
No, but I don't know, because we should be the center of figuring out how we can use nuclear in a way that actually can be part of the transition I talked about, because of Hanford, because we have the expertise and the technology right here in our state. We should be figuring out how to make it work.
And I think it's changing. The good news is it's changing with the leadership of people like Bill Gates and with Jim Hansen. I think many progressives are figuring out that, hey, it is emissionless. It does have a challenge. The trade-off is you got to deal with the waste. But it sure is a great way to make power for a city like Mumbai, for example.
Okay, another question. Got to go to Hillary first on this one. The federal government controls over 300 million acres of land in the West, including Washington, as you know. Would we be in better shape? Would it be better for the states to retain control and manage that land?
This is a great question, actually. I would tell you right now, they're the largest landowner in Washington State alone. We're the second largest. When you have that much land to manage, it's an enormous amount of cost, right? And so I would say we shouldn't move to controlling the federal lands. Instead, we move to a partnership, and we are already doing that. In 2017, when I first came in this office, I signed a good neighbor authority with the federal government that enables, because they have significantly underfunded resources in forest health, as well as many other areas, culvert removal and environment, We went and basically said, we're here. We already have boots on the ground doing work on our lands. Let me just walk over the boundary line and do work on your lands. I can do it for better efficiencies, economies of scale, and we'll get better results. So we're doing that in forest health. We're now doing that in salmon habitat restoration and recovery. And we're also doing it in recreation to connect our landscapes better.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Good answer. Bill.
What she said.
Okay.
Amen.
Oh. Wow. Oh, yeah. You didn't even have to say, can I get an amen on that? He just offered it right up.
You should move to Washington State. We want you here.
Miguel wants to know, in order to protect the Salish Sea and Pacific salmon, should we remove the four Snake River dams? Is this a partisan issue? This time we're going to start with Mr. Bryant.
It's not a partisan issue. Republican Congressman Simpson in Idaho has just come out saying that we should be looking at the environmental impact of these dams. In Washington State, we just $750,000
for another study. Yeah.
I think that we should also, while we're doing it, look at the potential environmental degradation of bringing down these dams and the impact it could have on salmon in the first 15 or 20 years. We have decades of silt that you're just not going to release down the Columbia River and not have some negative impact. So let's look at both sides of it. And we do need to still take into account the economic importance of those to certain communities. But when you have a situation as we do right now with the Salish Sea and with salmon recovery, I think we have to look at all options.
I'll add to that. I think first we need to make sure that one problem isn't the answer for the entire salmon recovery, because we all definitely have a part, okay? I think the second piece about the dams is I think we have an opportunity to look at that context of TransAlta, for example, where TransAlta was a facility that we were working to shut down coal, and we created an entire approach that would make sure that the jobs and the energy and the economic opportunity and the environment would be solved in a just transition. And I think we use this time right now to say, look, taking down the dams is going to have a huge impact socially, economically, and environmentally. How do we make sure we're ready to, so that all the communities that are impacted by it are ready to go, and we don't create a problem that we've had time to prepare for?
John, this kind of goes into the partisan thing, though. If you want to get support for just even talking about it on the other side of the mountains, we have to quit pretending that taking down the dams are going to save the salmon. Okay? If you want to save the salmon, let's deal with our stormwater problem over here before we go over there and tell them how they have to change their lives.
That's a perfect point. We too often are pointing to someone else as the problem when we're not owning our own roles.
Okay, very good. What should the role of environmental journalists be in informing the public about climate-related issues? Bob, we'll start with you.
Mostly tell stories that get through the heart blockage and into the head, because if we could get through the heart and into the head, all this would clear up pretty quickly, and we'd figure out that we're all in this together. But there's a heart blockage problem. And so it's a lot of storytelling that needs to be done. So, for example, Bill just told an important story that needs underscoring, is Mike Simpson from Idaho. You know, I had the brag earlier. I was from Redis District in the Redis State. We've done some work in Idaho. I pulled that punch in Idaho, okay? I'm not sure we're redder than Idaho. But Mike Simpson, a longtime House member, is really moved at a heart level about salmon. And I experienced that on the Snake River with Kathy McMorris Rogers, district director, when a biologist described to us as we were on this river tour, the biologist said, The fish are arriving so exhausted because of the temperature of the water due to climate change that they're dying eggs in the spawning grounds. And then he says, in 10 years, there may be no salmon run on the Snake River. And I looked over at Kathy's district director, and he looked like somebody had hit him with a 2x4 in the gut. Because for him, I mean, for me as a South Carolinian, it was sort of shocking. But I think for him, as a guy who grew up in Eastern Washington, it was something being taken from him. And so I would ask the environmental journalists to write up those kind of stories so that people can, we really operate on our hearts, we don't operate on our heads. But if we get through this heart problem and into the head would clear,
and we'd come to an agreement about how to deal with this. But it's stories like Bill was telling here about Mike Simpson.
Now, does that run the risk, though, of overplaying your hand? For instance, you've got Beto O'Rourke running for president who says, we've got 12 years and it's too late.
Yeah.
And, you know, many of you know Cliff Mass from the University of Washington, who has written the authoritative book, you know, on the weather and explains climate science very well, both on radio and on his blog and at the University of Washington, where he's been a climate scientist since 1982. He says, look, yes, we have steadily warming trends going on. Yes, mankind is, and his activities, is contributing to it. But stop saying it's all over in 12 years. And stop blaming fires in California on climate change. There's a number of reasons for that, including forest management. In other words, he is concerned that people will stop taking the issue seriously because of doomsday scenarios that either never come to pass, like the North Pole melting by 2013, that's Al Gore, or because it simply seems implausible. So that's the last thing I'll have each of you address as we are out of time. Go ahead, we'll start with Bill, then Bob, then Hillary gets the last word.
The need not to climb is.
Yeah, whenever we talk, I remember in high school we were going to be out of oil by now, right? I mean, and you're right, Al Gore said that the North Pole would be melted by now. And those kinds of things are very dangerous to do, and when they don't happen, then people begin to discount whatever they hear, and that's not where we want to be right now. I said earlier, I think we have 10 to 15 years in Puget Sound. I don't think that's an alarm bell. I think we have 10 to 15 years in Puget Sound. How do we get beyond that, I think, is exactly what the congressman said, is we tell stories that people can relate to. And I think that the environmental press at times doesn't tell the complete story. I think they fall too often into the narrative of the Republicans are the bad guys and the Democrats are the ones trying to save the planet, because that's an easy thing to write. But it's also not entirely their fault, because they're given maybe 700 words or 90 seconds. Some of these stories are very complicated to tell. And it would be nice if the really good environmental reporters, and we have some very good environmental reporters in Seattle that write both locally and nationally. Let me just, if you want a really good story and you want to understand wolves better, go back and read Chris Solomon's story in the New York Times from this summer. Okay. It's an excellent piece of writing, and it's the kind of writing on environmental issues that we need to have more of, because it tells the full story which needs to be told.
Yeah, we do need to not run into people breathless and say, you know, we're all going to die on next Tuesday. It's very important not to do that, especially when trying to reach the people we're trying to reach at republicen.org. So we need to talk to them about reasonable risk avoidance. The only problem with that is, ain't nobody ever written in the memo section of a check reasonable risk avoidance. You know, they will write save the planet, !, but they have never written reasonable risk avoidance in the memo section. Back to that discussion earlier about what makes environmental groups operate and how they get you to write in the memo section. But somehow there has to be a balance, John, between saying this is serious, there may be no salmon on the Snake River in 10 years, but not be breathless.
Okay.
And somehow that's it's a hard balance to strike.
The last word belongs to Hillary Franz.
I would say it would be very important for people to spend, journalism to spend less time on whether windmills cause cancer and whether raking our forests will prevent forest fires. I would also say in that context to not spend so much time on the doom and gloom depressing, which makes people feel like it's impossible for them to actually make a difference, and spend more time actually knitting the system of that I talked about in forest, that all of our environmental challenges we're facing are also our economic challenges and our social challenges. If we can start to say, what is the way we knit those problems or challenges together to be solutions that get the social, economic, and environmental win for our state and our nation, we will be able to change the hearts and minds and actually prevent any bipartisan divide and increase us working together and get solutions on the ground from all of us.
Hillary Franz, Bill Bryant, Bob Inglis. Did we save the best for last? How about that? Thank you very much, panel.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Resty Bacall and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. And just a reminder to save the date for the next Crosscut Festival, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. To learn more, go to crosscut.com/festival. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.